Hello, everybody. This is Scott Yates, Director of Communications and Producer Relations for the Washington Grain Commission, here with episode 43 of Wheat All About It, or what I'm calling The Vagaries of Varieties, about my conversation with Ryan Higginbotham, Director of the Washington State University's Variety Testing Program, or what I'll be referring to here as VTP. The purpose of the VTP is to evaluate the performance of wheat and barley varieties and experimental breeding lines across an array of production zones in eastern Washington. There was a period of time not all private companies were participating in the VTP. They are now, and as you'll hear ahead, Higginbotham makes it very clear that while he's a university employee, it's not his job to promote WSU varieties. I went to several of Higginbotham's small grain field days during the summer and recorded a portion of one of them for episode 29, the podcast entitled Plotting Wheat's Way Forward. This podcast is different. Chiefly, I'm not battling wind noise in the field, but rather seated comfortably in Higginbotham's Johnson Hall office on the WSU campus. Unlike most offices in the old building, one of Higginbotham's walls is painted crimson. His decorative scheme, other than that, leans toward photos of his young family and the artwork of his three under-10 children. In my last podcast, I mentioned Higginbotham's communication skills in front of a large group. I'm happy to report that he's just as good talking one-on-one. Did you ever notice how the VTP yields are always higher than the actual yields a farmer would expect to find in a field? There's a reason for that, as Higginbotham explains.
I think our yields in those plots will always be higher than what a farmer will see in the field, say, around the trial. You know, we're looking at a very small postage stamp size piece of that field. Typically, it's a good piece of ground. We're trying not to put the trials in a poor piece of the field. So it's a good piece of ground. You know, we've gotten in, hopefully, with the timely planting. We've controlled all the weeds that we can. We've controlled diseases that we can. You know, it's a tiny little area that it's been given every chance to succeed and produce maximum yield. And so what we see in those plots is going to be obviously inflated over what the farmer's going to see. So you can't necessarily look at those results and say, oh, well, this variety X yielded 90 bushel, and therefore if I plant that, I can expect to get 90 bushel. What you can do is you can compare the varieties among each other. So variety X was 90 and variety Y was 75. Okay, well, if I plant the one that yielded 90, you know, if we have a long-term average where it's been consistently better, then I would expect in that field to get a higher yield with that variety.
Is there any rule of thumb for how much lower a farm would be than a plot?
Not that I'm aware of. You know, if I look at results, you know, for example, one year in a location, this year we had the trial average in my trial was 135 bushel an acre. The farmer's field around it was 108. So what would that be? I'm not real quick with percentages, but somebody could do the math and tell you what percentage difference that is. But, you know, it's going to be different for different precipitation zones too. You know, I would think at a place like Lind, where yields are just lower in general, the percentage is not going to be quite as high, but our plot yields will always be higher than the farmer's field.
So you've been in this position now for 3 years, is that correct?
Yeah. Started on paper. I transitioned in on September 1st of 2014. It's just past 3 year anniversary. And then, you know, there was a little transition period, but for all purposes, yeah, 3 years it's been.
And how does this crop shape up with the other two that you have observed?
Well, my first year was not a great one to make the jump into the program because we had widespread drought. Yields were low. You know, we had lots of variation in the trials, had to abandon several locations because the data just was not usable or the trial was a disaster. So that was not a ton of fun to jump into the first year. You know, this year has been really good in terms of winter wheat yields, you know, especially in the places where we historically see yields in the 40s to 50s. You know, we've seen quite a bit higher than that with the excess moisture. Now, in the high rainfall this year, it was a little bit different. The yields were still good, but they didn't get the advantage as the low rainfall places did with all that extra moisture. And then last year was sort of a mixed bag. You know, last year, everybody just wanted to talk about falling numbers, and I think they've kind of forgot about how things actually yielded.
Higginbotham's right. People did forget how well the winter wheat crop yielded in 2016 because of the falling number snafu. For the record, the 2016 winter wheat yield set the record for biggest yield per acre at 78 bushels. The average winter wheat yield in Washington in 2017 was 73 bushels. Regarding Higginbotham's example of the yield in plots versus the farm surrounding it, 108 bushels is 25% less than 135 bushels. I ask Higginbotham, who hails from a wheat farm in the intermediate rainfall area around Elmira, to comment on the difference between the high and low rainfall regions of the state in 2017.
It seemed to me that in the drier areas, you know, moisture is their limiting factor still. It doesn't matter how much fertilizer they put on. If they don't get moisture, the yield's not going to come. And so they were able to capitalize on that. You know, timings were normal in terms of the planting date last fall for those drier areas. They weren't delayed by those rains. And then the rain started coming, and they were able to capitalize on that. You know, and I think the earlier harvest out there, the crop was at a different stage when we had that extended hot spell. So it impacted things differently in the drier area. In general, the lower rainfall areas were really able to take advantage of that extra moisture. Whereas the high rainfall, sometimes too much of a good thing is not a good thing. And they were delayed in planting last fall. It was so wet this spring, things never got up and going early enough. And then it got hot and it just kind of shut things down.
And what about your winter plots? Did your technicians get those in the ground before the October rains or after the October rains?
We beat the rains, I think, at every location. Our last seeding date was in November, and that was clear down at Bickleton. So we didn't beat it there. We were delayed quite a while because of the rain there. But at all of our normal locations, we got in, snuck in. And it's easy for us to sneak in and plant for an hour, hour and a half between rainstorms or on a day when maybe a farmer can't finish planting or certainly can't plant a whole field. We can sneak in and put a trial in the ground.
There was a lot of talk out west when I was visiting with elevator operators about Otto and Jasper and Curiosity and some other WSU varieties, and not a lot of conversation about the privates. Comments?
Yeah, well, for starters, let me just make it crystal clear that it makes no difference to me whose variety a farmer plants. But I think that there's some truth to your statement in that generally in the low rainfall areas of the state, historically it's been WSU varieties. And in part because the program has been here for so long, I don't know how many, if it's been 100 years yet, it's been a long time. And it takes a long time to develop a germplasm base that's adapted for that low rainfall environment. And that's exactly what the breeders here at WSU have. Whereas the private companies are newer, and so they're starting not necessarily from scratch, but they don't have the history. And frankly, there's not as much incentive for them to target some of these niche areas where there's a lot of saved seed. So there's not a ton of return on investment for them to develop a variety that does well with less than 6 inches of precipitation. It makes much more sense for them to focus on a high rainfall area where it's a large percentage of certified seed and they can get return on that investment. So yeah, I think that in the low rainfall, there are probably more WSU varieties than the private companies. It's not to say they're not making gains. I think we're going to see some varieties in the next couple of years that will compete with and certainly beat some of the current WSU varieties out in that low rainfall.
How are you dealing with the numbers? 20 years ago, there were just no private varieties out here. Where have we gone in terms of numbers of lines, I guess we would call them, lines and varieties, that you're having to deal with now?
Well, if there's anything that makes me want to look for a different job, it's the number of varieties that I have to sort through each year. And this year, for example, we've even entered into a new era where there are licensed varieties out there. So there have been three that at least I'm aware of that have been licensed by private companies that they're offering under their own branding. I have three of those in my trials that we're planting this fall. So, you know, it just adds to the trial. I'm trying to keep them at a manageable size, but yet also trying to meet the needs of the growers and be able to trial some of these newer varieties to see if they might be a good fit in some of these areas. Wanting to make sure we've got even playing field and get everything to the table. The other thing that is difficult is trying to balance released varieties with experimental lines, because Most farmers are interested in what they can go out and plant this fall or next spring. There's always a handful that are looking for the next variety that might be a couple years out, but most of them are concerned with what they can currently go out and plant. But I need to have a balance because we need to be able to look at those new ones and see where they might have a fit. How do they compare to what's out there currently? So it helps the breeding program decide what to advance or what to not to advance. But yeah, the numbers are a challenge every year to sit down and go through an entry list. So in my winter trial last year, what we just harvested, 56% of the entries were public and 44% were private. So pretty evenly balanced. And on the spring side, it was almost dead even at 51% public lines and 49% private.
Fascinating. Will this be the first year that you're using your new direct seed drill to plant?
It will, yeah. So the Grain Commission graciously gave us some funds to upgrade and modify a no-till drill that we had previously been using. It just was not real representative of what the farmers are actually doing. And the design of the drill itself made it difficult for us to plant in a real high residue situation. So we modified that. We've got it here on campus. We're trying to figure out actually how to make it work this week in terms of getting the timing down and making sure the fertilizer delivery system is working. And we'll be starting to plant with that next week. So I'm excited to see how it works. This has a hoe type opener. So we have an old one that was made, I don't even know how long ago, but it was homemade here on campus by some of the researchers and their technicians. And it has a cross-slot opener, so more of a disc opener. And it works great in some situations, but it's really hard to get that in the ground, in particular on the Palouse where we have that clay soil in the fall, and it's really hard. So the hoe opener is easier to get in the ground. This one is going to have 5 openers instead of 4, which our previous hoe drill only had 4. So the spacing will more accurately represent what farmers are doing, and I think it'll be a much better fit.
So how will you decide which crops or which varieties or which locations to plant with your no-till drill and which to plant conventionally?
That's based off of what the cooperator is doing. So if I work with a farmer, say, for example, in Colton, my cooperator there plants all of his farm using a no-till drill. He's the farmer that we plant the trial with, and so if we're going to plant in his field, then we need to plant with our no-till drill. We plant everything on X number of foot plots. So for example, in the real low rainfall, we're planting 20-foot length plots, and then we have a 4-foot alley. So that brings the final harvestable plot to 16 feet. In other places, we'll plant a 16-foot plot, still have that 4-foot alley, so that brings the harvestable plot to 12 feet. So it varies based on rainfall zone. We moved to the 20-foot plots in the low rainfall because 2 years ago, yields were so low, we didn't even have enough grain from some of those locations to fill a test weight cup or to get a protein value. So we thought we better increase the plot length to make sure we get enough grain to measure some of these other parameters.
What about treatment for stripe rust? How do you deal with that?
Well, our standard practice now is to include a fungicide at herbicide timing at all of our locations, whether we spray it or the cooperator sprays it. And then from there, my goal is to try and manage stripe rust as a farmer would. So if we have a heavy rust pressure year, I want to control that so we don't have stripe rust yield loss in the trial. Now, I have 24 winter wheat testing locations, and I'm just one person. I have 2 full-time employees, but we can't see everything on a weekly basis to be able to monitor when that rust comes back into the trial and how bad it's getting. So there are some cases where we probably will miss it. You know, we'll all show up and make a decision not to spray based on what I see that given day. And then a week later, maybe the rust will blow up and we'll be late on an application or just flat miss it. So there's going to be some cases like that, but the goal is to manage so that we have no stripe rust impact.
So you were saying that you tank mix your fungicide with your herbicide. I'm curious, do you also tank mix multiple herbicides?
If the situation calls for it, we're trying to be basic. You know, I don't want to mix in a whole bunch of different chemistries, but there are some places where we have a problem weed that what we would normally spray with, we won't control it. So we'll add an additional herbicide in there to try and combat that problem weed at a given location.
In the same way that we look at 2014 and 2015, which were moisture deficit years, do we look at this year, 2017, and go, well, shoot, we need to throw this one out too because it's really not average at all?
I don't know that we throw it out. I think that we lump it in with those lower years, and that kind of rounds out the average so that we can see how things perform over multiple years. So, because like I said, you don't know when you plant in August or September how much rainfall you're going to get. The farmers asked me what to plant, and I said, well, you tell me what kind of winter we're going to have, what disease pressures are you going to deal with, how much rainfall are you going to get, and I'll give you a good variety to plant, but they can't tell me that.
Okay, let's move down to the last precipitation zone, which is under 12 inches.
And in this one, the highest yielding line in the less than 12-inch zone was actually an experimental line. But in terms of the released varieties, the ones atop the list were Mila, CL Plus, Norwest Duet. Coda is an older line that didn't plant this fall. It's just fallen out of favor. So we're trying to make room for some of these new ones like SY Banks right up there towards the top in that low rainfall. Curiosity, Pritchett is a relatively new club line from the ARS and WSU here on campus. And then there again, there's Zerfa, followed closely by Otto. So Otto still performed pretty consistently in that low rainfall, and that's its sweet spot.
Every year has its own challenges. What were the challenges in the 2017 crop year?
I think getting things in the ground last fall was a challenge. We were able to sneak things in a timely manner. This spring, getting spring trials established and in the ground in a timely manner was difficult because it was just so wet. For all the talk about stripe rust, yeah, we had some stripe rust, but we were able to keep that under control at just about all the locations. I think the hardest thing was just all the moisture and trying to figure out why aren't things taking off and growing this spring. Is it a variety problem? Is it a soil problem? Is it just too much rain? So it was, the moisture was probably the most challenging aspect.
Ryan, every year when I go to your plot tours, you announce that there are certain locations that you're not going to release the numbers for. Why is that?
Well, every year we have locations that have some sort of issue, whether it's weather-related. Sometimes we make a mistake. Certainly there's locations where I've screwed something up by something I've done, and that's unfortunate. But, I'm a big boy. I'll own my mistakes. But the ones where I don't release it, it's usually something went wrong. So, for example, this year we didn't release the results from the Lamont winter trials. I received a phone call. Usually I get a couple a year from a grower that's concerned or frustrated, and I get that it's frustrating that they don't get the results from a given location. I will always give them the results for their own personal use with the understanding that they're not real valuable in terms of predicting future performance. But, if an individual farmer wants to have them, I'm absolutely willing to give them the results for them to look at and see if they can discern something from.
And so why aren't they valuable? I mean, aren't bad numbers better than no numbers at all?
I would say that no data or no numbers are better than bad numbers or bad data. And what I mean by that is I want things to be consistent across the trial. So if this particular trial in Lamont, it was nobody's fault. It just, we had a lot of variation. So for example, a given entry in one rep, we plant three reps of every entry, so there's three plots of everything across the trial. In one rep, it was 104 bushels an acre, and in another rep, it was only 57. So a 45-50 bushel spread, and that's just something I can't handle because I don't know why. It wasn't the variety's fault. Now, if it were consistently good or consistently bad, that's useful information. But when it's just all over the place, it's not useful in terms of deciding what is the true value for that plot. In a normal year, would it have yielded 104 bushel or would it have yielded 57? So it's hard to kind of pinpoint where that variety falls when it doesn't perform well consistently across the trial. And when you have a lot of variation across the trial, that's the problem, is that it makes it really difficult to look at an average and say, well, why did it average that? Was it good across all reps? Was it bad across all reps? Or did it have one plot that was, yielded half as much as the others?
So there was a time here not long ago when the privates were not entering their lines into your plot work. Are we getting all of the privates' lines into your plots at this point?
At this point, I would say yes. Everybody who is breeding wheat and barley varieties in the Northwest is entering varieties into the trial. At the point now where I have at least one experimental line from every breeding program in the Northwest. So I think everybody is come to the table and willing to play. And I think in part, you know, I hope that I've earned their trust just by not releasing results that don't have value. You know, there's no point in putting out trial results that have no value. And, you know, never once has a breeder called me to complain about a trial where their variety was at the top of the list. But I do hear complaints when their varieties don't do well. Now, sometimes they're just not adapted to that certain area. But, you know, by not releasing results that from trials that were just bad, I think that goes a long ways in earning trust, in particular with the breeding programs.
I couldn't get all the good parts of my conversation with Higginbotham into a single podcast. And rather than get all frustrated, I'm creating a two-parter. Next week, tune in for episode 44, or what I'm calling Location, 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 a continuation of my conversation with Ryan Higginbotham, dwelling on the performance of winter wheat varieties during the 2016-2017 growing season. That's all the time we have for now. Thanks for listening to episode 43 of Wheat All About It, or what I titled The Vagary of Varieties. I hope you'll join me again for another episode of Wheat All About It.
We're all children of a special treat, a miracle of nature that we just call wheat. A crop that's in the Bible, a crop that's in our bread, a crop that's filled our bellies and held us in good stead. Through a history of starvation and times of want and woe, wheat has been our savior, our grub, our goulash dough. There's always lots of problems when we have enough to eat, but there's only one dilemma when there's not enough wheat. We feed you.